Support for 89.7 NPR News comes from the James at Ohio State. The best outcomes for treating cancer come from early detection. The James Cancer Diagnostic Center is designed to provide rapid evaluation and a clear diagnosis to those who suspect they have cancer. Learn more at cancer.osu.edu/diagnosticcenter.
Welcome to All Sides and the Reporter Roundtable, an hour where we catch up on the political news of last week and preview the week ahead. I'm your host, Amy Jurevich. And joining us for the first roundtable of the new year, we have Laura Bischoff, politics and state government reporter for the Columbus Dispatch. Welcome back, Laura.
Happy New Year.
Karen Kassler, bureau chief for the Ohio Public Radio Statehouse News Bureau. Welcome back, Karen.
Great to be here. Happy 2026.
And Andrew Tobias, state government and politics reporter for Signal Ohio. Welcome back, Andrew.
Thanks for having me.
So first, let's start with the big unfolding story nationally, Venezuela's ousting of President Nicolas Maduro. He is now in jail in New York, indicted on drug-related charges following the surprise U.S. military operation over the weekend that captured Maduro and his wife. The attack took place without knowledge or approval of Congress and raised questions of legality, presidential power, and what comes next. So let's just start with, you know, there was a rally on Sunday organized by a group at the Ohio State House to demonstrate against this U.S. action. We've seen reaction from Ohio politicians, leaders, lawmakers. Andrew, what do you make of the reaction coming from everyone from Vice President J.D. Vance to both of our U.S. senators?
You know, in something like this, it feels like history that's playing out in real time. So it's kind of hard to really kind of like play this out and to know how this is going to kind of go over politically, which is how I think about things as a political reporter. But one thing I'll say is over the weekend when it happened, I heard from some Democratic communications people who really wanted to see they basically want reporters to put Republicans on the spot to see what they think about this. And I think their thought process is probably something along the lines of not knowing what the general public sentiment is, something about something that's so fresh that they're just kind of betting that Americans want their politicians to do things that help people with their domestic lives, things that affect them from day to day, and that they're not going to be, you know, like foreign policy always ranks so low when you poll in elections and stuff like that. So that's probably how they're viewing it. But like, it's such a dynamic situation. It's hard to know, like I said at the beginning of my whole little like, soliloquy here, how is it really gonna, how are people gonna view this, you know, a month from now, much less a year from now?
Yeah. Laura, what do you make of lawmakers? Are they just gonna toe the party line here? Republicans will agree with it, Democrats will not.
That has been the kind of the first cut out of the gate. I do think that there's an interesting split within the MAGA groups on this, because there's like a faction that will support Donald Trump and his actions without much questioning. And then there's also a faction, I think, that opposes the United States intervening in foreign countries, you know, wasn't real hot on the Iraq war. And so this could open a divide among Trump supporters. But I think Andrew's right. It's kind of playing out. It's very fresh and TBD.
Yeah. And Karen, do you think the average Ohioan knows why this is happening? Do they know enough about Venezuela and Maduro to, or is it like Andrew said, where foreign policy kind of ranks low?
Well, I think for most people, domestic policy is the bigger issue. And that's been some of the arguments that Republicans like Marjorie Taylor Greene, who's leaving Congress, have talked about as being something that they wanted to see Trump focus on more. But, you know, this happened in a holiday period, so there wasn't a whole lot of news. So if you turned on the news, you probably did see something about this. So why it's happening, though, I mean, go on social media and there's a lot of rationale being thrown around as to why it's happening. And so I think we're still trying to, I think, listen to what the Trump administration is saying about what's going to happen now and what did happen and what's going to happen next.
Yeah, and I found some of the comments interesting. You know, one of the ones that I found interesting is our former Republican Governor John Kasich posted a video where he said, you know, let's be clear, Maduro is a very bad guy, but does it justify direct military intervention in Venezuela by the United States? There are new precedents being established. So it sounds like someone like Kasich, who is maybe not a, you know, MAGA loyalist, is like hedging his bets there. Laura, what do you think of that?
That's a true statement. He is not a MAGA loyalist. Matter of fact,
I think
he's
that's
the
an
opposite.
Understatement.
He's the opposite.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. But I think you know, people can agree that Maduro was problematic, bad guy leader. Mm-hmm. But there's a lot of those in countries around the world, and you know, when is it appropriate for the United States to go in and pull them out of bed and arrest them and take them across the globe
yes,
to America?
It definitely seems like something out of a, you know, TV miniseries or a movie, right? For more updates on this unfolding story, you can stay with NPR News, and we can discuss more about what Ohio leaders are saying and what lawmakers are saying, and you'll hear more from the WOSU News team over the coming days. But Andrew, I also wanted to get your reaction, you know, over the holidays. It's not just Venezuela and the Venezuelan boat attacks that happened before, but the continued ICE raids. Do you feel like Democrats are going to take all of this to their advantage to boost Democratic candidates across the U.S. and here in Ohio? A lot of Democrats are coming out and just saying negative things about the news we're hearing.
Yeah, this is probably not something that's on the top of mind for most kind of normal people, but I've noticed throughout Amy Acton's campaign, she's the Democrat running for governor, she's made a lot of hay out of a tweet that Republican Vivek Ramaswamy made about a year ago, in which he defended the H-1B visa system through which companies can hire foreign workers with special skills to come in and take jobs. That's kind of like the overview of it. And Acton's repeatedly highlighted that to say, because in Ramaswamy's tweet, he talked about how he thought that was happening not because, you know, foreigners are smarter than Americans, but that American culture doesn't place a high enough premium on excellence and the pursuit of excellence and stuff like that. And Acton said that that comment, which Ramaswamy got a lot of flack over when it happened, showed that he thinks that Americans are lazy. And so I think that has been a way for her to kind of like attack Ramaswamy on an immigration related issue without actually calling it that. You know, Democrats have been pretty supportive of immigration policy being looser in the sense of it, you know, being tolerant and making America a welcome country and all that stuff. So for something like this, I think if they are trying to figure out a way to kind of get to the right of Republicans on an immigration issue, it just kind of put into stark relief, like, this is Trump's immigration policy. And it kind of puts them on the spot to, you know, stake out kind of the more left position. So that's how I look at it more. I think you could argue that for Democrats that it would be beneficial for them politically to seem kind of more either moderate or even conservative on this kind of stuff. And it's really hard for them to do that if they see something happening that they think is a government overreach that people in the community they're representing are going to likely oppose and stuff like that. So that's the way I look at this, again, which is maybe a weird way that normal people would not really even, that's like a tweet from a year ago wouldn't even enter their brains.
You're not normal people.
No, not at all.
All right. Well, you're listening to the All Sides Weekly Reporter Roundtable on 89.7 NPR News, and we're listening to Andrew Tobias from Signal Ohio, Laura Bischoff from the Columbus Dispatch, and Karen Kassler from the Ohio Public Radio State House News Bureau. Moving on, we turn the calendar to a new year, and the holidays are over, and the Buckeyes' dream of a second national championship died last week, so lawmakers are due back soon. And I wanted to just frame and kind of set the table for 2026 by summing up 2025. I wanted to get the three of you to just basically say, what do you think, if you were going to summarize 2025 based on what Ohio lawmakers prioritized, how would you characterize it? Karen, do you want to start?
Well, I don't know that this is prioritized, but I mean, I think it was the biggest topic of the year was property taxes. Mm-hmm. And lawmakers didn't do a whole ton on that. They made some moves, but certainly the people who are pushing for the abolishment of property taxes don't think that was enough. And in the budget, there was an income tax cut, but nothing specifically on property taxes. So, I mean, I think that was just the biggest topic of conversation, and it will be as we're going into this year as well. I mean, you've got a race for governor where that's going to come up as a big deal. So I think, I know you wanted to talk about property taxes a little bit more later, mm-hmm. but I think that was a big story coming out of last year and going into this one.
Yeah. Laura, what do you make of like summarizing up 2025 as we head into the new year here?
Yeah, I mean, I agree with Karen. Property taxes was a big one. I also think that, you know, the lawmakers coming up with a compromise on marijuana reforms, mm-hmm. and how to deal with THC products. And now that has become a flashpoint, and there's a referendum attempt on that. It's interesting because both marijuana policy and property taxes might end up on the ballot.
Mm. And Andrew, what do you make of summing up 2025?
Yeah, so like legislatively, you know, at the beginning of the year, the legislature passed Senate Bill 1, which put a bunch of new restrictions on universities, kind of fighting back against what Republicans see as them being too liberal. That's more of a culture war issue. That's kind of what we saw a lot of over the last several years from Republicans. But once they put that aside, which it was a big thing.
I can't believe that was still 2025. That feels like 10 years ago.
Right. But
okay.
But, you know, they spent the year, you know, on property taxes, which is kind of more of a kind of kitchen table issue. And then on marijuana stuff, they kind of sought out kind of more of a compromise type position. So by and large, we saw the, you know, legislature kind of put that stuff off to the side once they kind of got the big thing out of the way. And the other thing I wanted to say quickly is that we have two candidates for governor, Amy Acton and Vivek Ramaswamy. If you'd have asked me who either of them were 5 years ago, I couldn't have told you. And, you know, kind of, that's an interesting contrast with how we see politicians like John Husted or Dave Yost, the attorney general, who kind of like have long term, like they get elected to one thing. And this is like my 10-year plan for my life. And this is what I'm going to do next. And it kind of shows how, you know, we as reporters, politicians, you know, make these plans about how they think things are going to play out over the long term. And then things come totally out of left field. You know, you have, and that's kind of more typical, I think, of politics today, with, you know, Donald Trump being the best example when he ran for president 10 years ago.
You can't predict the future, Andrew? Not yet?
I try. Yeah. I fail. Right. Yeah.
So, Karen, you mentioned property taxes. You wrote about property taxes and the back and forth over months. It resulted in bills that Governor DeWine did sign into law in late December, but there are still a lot more bills floating around out there. Do you think any of them have some traction in 2026?
Well, I think the couple that we keep hearing about are the circuit breaker, which triggers a property tax cut after a certain level of household income, and then the expansion of the homestead tax exemption. These have been proposed several times. The question is, how do you make up that money, which will be lost to school districts and local governments? And so I think that there's going to be discussion about those. Those were both mentioned in the Joint Committee on Property Tax Reform, whatever it was called, from the last General Assembly. They put out a big bunch of recommendations. And then the Governor Mike DeWine's task force after the budget put out recommendations. Both of those ideas were mentioned. They have been proposed. So I think that they're bipartisan. They've been out there for a while. The question is, why haven't they moved? And so I think that that's going to get some discussion.
From a story you produced, we have audio from Brian Massey, who is on the committee to abolish property taxes, which Laura mentioned earlier, that there's a referendum to completely abolish property taxes. Let's listen to Brian.
The committee is saying, you blew it when you didn't think about the average citizen. And now we're going to get the signatures and we're going to let the citizens vote.
Laura, what do you make of this, where they're at with this property tax idea of putting it on the ballot to completely abolish all property taxes? How are they doing with the signatures?
It's my understanding that they don't have paid petition circulators. And so that's a ding against them. It's really hard to make the ballot in Ohio. You know, you just have to collect twice as many signatures as you are required to have, just because so many of them get thrown out as invalid. And so it's just enormously time consuming and expensive, and to do it just based on volunteers. And the other thing is, they don't have like a natural constituency. Like, you know, if you were going to go for minimum wage, you might get unions to help circulate the petitions, etc. So I think it's an uphill battle for them. However, you know, it's high stakes. If they make the ballot, there's a really good chance it could pass. You know, it's maybe would throw school funding into complete disarray across the state and create a crisis. However, it's really appealing to voters. Like, oh yeah, I don't want to pay property taxes. It's sort of like saying, let's have a law, let's make a constitutional amendment so that everybody gets Friday off. Everyone gets a 3-day weekend. Well, sure, I'd be for that. You know,
yeah.
I'd be also be for, like, you know, not having to pay gobs of money in property taxes. But it's not necessarily good policy.
When you talked to Brian, what did he say about that?
I've talked to him a couple of times. The most recent was at a gathering of the County Commissioners County Commissioners Association of Ohio. So it was a room full of county commissioners who are overwhelmingly Republican in Ohio. And this was not a friendly environment to the property tax abolishment folks, because these county commissioners deal with property taxes. Property taxes fund the things that they are supporting here and working toward. And I think it's really interesting to note what Laura said about how there isn't a natural consistency. I mean, there's conservative groups that have been leading this, but there's even some infighting among those groups in terms of, okay, what would happen if property taxes are eliminated? How do you fund the things that you care about? It's been brought up by Representative David Thomas, who has been involved in virtually all the property tax bills in the legislature. Mm-hmm. He has said, we can't protect people from property tax increases that they themselves vote for when they vote for levies. And in the last levy cycle in November, we saw 65.5% of levies passed and 90% of library levies passed. So there's definitely a struggle, I think, among people who want to support their local thing but are concerned about rising property taxes. And so this is just a really interesting conversation. But if it does get on the ballot, I think Laura's right that it does have a chance of passing, but I think you will see a massive effort to try to defeat it at every level. State and local, all elected officials practically will be on board as saying this is not the way to deal with this.
Finally, something to unite Democrats and Republicans and independents.
A truly bipartisan issue, I guess.
Taxes of all things. But does Brian and his group, do they say what will replace all this, or that's not his job?
They say that that's not their job. Hmm. That their job is to go ahead and put this on the ballot, and then it's up to lawmakers who are elected to do these things to figure that out. And that was one of the things that got real pushback at this county commissioners group, because basically there was one county commissioner from Lucas County who said, you can't just come in here and abolish property taxes, throw that bomb, and then just walk away like you've done your job, because then the chaos that would result for schools and local governments, I mean, you're talking about everything from zoos to police and fire, mm-hmm. to all of these different agencies and public services that are funded by property taxes. If you just eliminate that funding source, what happens? And they say that it's lawmakers and elected officials that would have to come up with that.
So just to sum up, they want this to be on the November ballot.
Yes.
And so they have to have the signatures by
443,000 or so valid signatures. So Laura said you have to gather mm-hmm. about twice that by the I think it's the first week of June. June 30th, July 1st, somewhere around there. It is a huge mountain mm-hmm. to climb. And I don't think, I've been trying to do some research, I don't think I've seen a volunteer effort gather the kind of signatures that are needed to put a constitutional amendment before voters.
Hmm. All right, so we'll be talking about this again if they have all the way till June, though. So coming up, we're going to talk about health care. We're going to talk about federal funding for child care. And we're also going to talk about another thing that might make it on the ballot related to hemp and cannabis laws. That is when the roundtable from all sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
How does AI even work? Where does creativity come from? What's the secret to living longer? TED Radio Hour explores the biggest questions with some of the world's greatest thinkers. They will surprise, challenge, and even change you. Listen to NPR's TED Radio Hour wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to the All Sides Weekly Reporter Roundtable, an hour where we talk about all things Ohio politics. I'm your host, Amy Jarovich. With us this week, we have Karen Kassler, Bureau Chief for the Ohio Public Radio Statehouse News Bureau, Laura Bischoff, Politics and State Government Reporter for the Columbus Dispatch, and Andrew Tobias, State Government and Politics Reporter for Signal Ohio. And another issue that could head back to voters this fall relates to the new hemp and cannabis law. So, Laura, you mentioned this briefly earlier in the show, and I wanted to circle back. Last week, Ohioans for Cannabis Choice submitted its initial petition signatures for an effort to repeal the new law. So what exactly are they taking issue with? What do they want to put in front of the voters?
Well, this Senate bill, I think it's 56 or 57, which the governor signed on December 19th, it includes a bunch of restrictions about marijuana use that weren't in the voter-approved law, mm-hmm. like restrictions on smoking it in public places, has some other ways in which it kind of waters down the rights. It says, like, you could also be penalized if, like, not eligible for, like, an organ transplant or other things if you use marijuana. So, anyway.
I hadn't heard that, yeah. Is it also the thing where you can't change the packaging? Is that a part of it, too, Andrew? Yeah, yeah, okay.
Anyway, and then also there was the lawmakers came up with, like, a carve-out for THC-infused seltzers that are produced by a lot of, you know, breweries across Ohio and sold in gas stations and wine shops and et cetera. And the governor struck that out. So that's another area. You know, mostly I think the governor really wanted to attack the THC infused candies and other things that are sold regardless of age. There's hardly any verification about what's in it and who's buying it, et cetera. But anyway, the advocacy group is taking issue with this. They have to get I think for a referendum, it's like 248,000 valid signatures within a 90-day window in order to block it from taking effect in mid-March. And then it would be on the November ballot for voters to weigh in. You know, this is, again, you know, getting on the ballot in Ohio, it's not as easy as it sounds. This would be kind of a heavy lift. I think the last referendum in Ohio might have been the attempt again to block House Bill 6, the nuclear bailout bill that benefited First Energy and led to this entire scandal and trial of the former Speaker of the House. And that one, you know, there was this fierce counter campaign that killed off the signature gathering effort so that, you know, they choked it in the crib before it ever grew up to be an actual referendum.
Hmm. So basically what this group wants to do is stop this law from going into effect. So DeWine signed it on December 19th, as Laura said, and then it goes into effect in 90 days. Do I have that right? They want to, you know, stop it before it starts.
Yeah, and that deadline falls sometime in late March. Mm-hmm. And something that's important to point out is that the group that is pursuing this includes a couple, at least publicly, a couple of people who are in the hemp business. So they kind of have money on the line here. And I could see it being a really easy sell to people like maybe breweries or people who farm this stuff or people who sell it to fund the signature gathering effort. Because if they're successful at collecting the signatures and scheduling the vote, they don't have to win the vote. They just have to, it delays the law until November. And something that's out there is that there's kind of like a belief, who knows if this is true or not, that the federal government, which voted to ban THC drinks, although the ban doesn't take effect until the end of 2026, might go back on that. So if they can just buy time to lobby the federal government to say that these are okay, that'd be money well spent if they can continue to sell these things all year. So, but it is still, you have to like, physically go and get the signatures. You have to convince cold people at the mall to stop and sign a piece of paper from a stranger. So it's easier said than done, but I think there's at least a clear path to fund something like that and to hire the people to go get those signatures.
And not to go back in time too much, but did any of you find it surprising that, you know, the House and Senate passed this bill and it included allowing the THC-infused drinks, which I think a lot of bars and breweries and places like that were very happy about, that they lobbied the House and Senate to allow those to continue, and it just regulated all the other hemp stuff, but then the governor got rid of that. Were you surprised that the governor went against the House and Senate and struck that part?
Not really. I think he's been very concerned. He's talked about the whole issue of unregulated THC products basically since 2023, when right after voters approved that that ballot issue. But I think he's been very concerned. And also there's federal requirements on the THC beverages. And so, you know, there's that. I think there's the idea that all that can be revisited if the federal law changes at some point. But no, I'm not surprised, because I think DeWine really doesn't like any of that stuff.
Yeah. I think there's also a divide in the cannabis industry overall. There's the interest of the marijuana dispensaries that are licensed and they're selling the products. And then this THC, you know, seltzers and candies and the rest of it which is hemp-based products. I think that there's, you know, kind of divergent business interests.
Yeah, so the marijuana dispensaries would want this all gone no matter what. They don't want any of it around.
Yeah, I think it would drive more traffic to the dispensaries.
Right. Okay. Well, moving on from that, more than 500,000 Ohioans who benefited from the Affordable Care Act and its enhanced subsidies, the subsidies expired last Thursday, January 1st, with Congress at an impasse on whether or how to extend them. This leaves Ohioans and millions of other Americans facing higher health care premiums here in the new year. It's also an issue that's emerging as a key issue in the U.S. Senate race between current Senator John Husted and his challenger, former Senator Sherrod Brown. Karen, the State House News Bureau spoke with both men about this issue. I'm going to play audio from each of them. Here is Senator Husted.
Every problem in the healthcare system is something that Sherrod Brown created over the last 32 years. He voted to end these premium subsidies in 2025. He's the one that put the Obamacare system in place that limits people's choices.
Karen, what about Husted's comments there that Brown is responsible for all these problems? He voted to end these subsidies, but wasn't Brown a supporter of the Affordable Care Act?
I think it just shows you how important that issue is going to be, especially as people have lost those enhanced ACA premium benefits. And, I mean, Congress is supposed to come back and do something in the next couple of weeks. There might be a one-year extension, I think. But Republicans are talking about something different than Democrats want to see happen. And so, you know, there are some states even that have made moves to try to fill that gap so that people can still sign up for go to the marketplace and sign up for health insurance, because people have been saying, and we've heard it here in Ohio as well, that they just simply can't afford health insurance without those enhanced premiums because the prices have gone up so much. And so those subsidies, without the help of those subsidies, they can't do anything. So I think this is going to be a hugely important issue as we go forward, and it's really hitting immediately.
Sherrod Brown has been holding forums on health care. He's criticized Husted for his 9 votes against restoring the subsidies. Brown has said that people should be able to get decent health care at reasonable rates. He also shared a story about a business owner who can't afford to continue health insurance for his family without the subsidies they've been getting.
He's going to go without insurance. He's in a pretty high-risk job. I don't know how old he was. He wasn't in his 20s or 30s. And his going out without insurance could cost him and his family for sure, but it also means prices go up for others as somebody like him checks out of the insurance pool.
Andrew, what's your take on this race right now? Because it's, you know, it's not just about healthcare. The race has even been splitting labor endorsements. Brown's campaign, and Brown's campaign back in the day against Bernie Moreno is one of the costliest in history. I mean, what do you make of where this is going this year?
So we were talking about the Venezuela thing earlier, and I think, like, if I had to guess, that's probably a political neutral, maybe really negative if a war breaks out or something like that. Something like this, where you're talking about what people are paying out of their pockets every day, where you have 550,000 people who are going to see their healthcare premiums go up dramatically, that's something that is going to electorally really matter. So it makes sense that Brown wants to talk about it. What's kind of interesting is to hear Husted, who's the incumbent, he normally would get blamed for everything bad that's going on in the country. He's trying to say that Sherrod Brown's actually to blame because Brown, who's the challenger, was actually the guy who was there for a really long time. And Husted's been in the Senate for like 5 minutes. So I don't know where voters are going to come down on that one. But I mean, I increasingly do think it's going to be a good election year nationally for Democrats. Whether that is enough for somebody like Sherrod Brown to win here, we'll find out.
Yeah. Laura, what do you think of Husted being an incumbent, but he hasn't even been there for 5 minutes? Is Sherrod Brown going to take the blame for everything here?
I don't know. I mean, both of them have their entire careers have been in public offices. So each one of them could point the finger for, you know, the blame or the credit on all these different issues. I do think that, you know, the healthcare subsidies fall squarely within this argument over or key buzzword about affordability, affordability in the economy, in wages, in housing, in healthcare. I think that that is, you know, like a key battleground for these candidates. But I also think that, you know, I think that the how Donald Trump is viewed next fall is really going to influence the race hugely.
And this is nerdy, but 2024, the Senate, control of the Senate was up for grabs. And so that's why you saw the party spending a lot of money. They wanted to, the Democrats wanted to protect Sherrod Brown here in Ohio. They wanted to keep control of the Senate. So different seats are up for election in different election cycles. And this year, Republicans hold the Senate. And if Democrats want to change that, they have to beat Republicans in some pretty Republican states like Montana, like Ohio, like Alaska, like Texas. So that's the thing that could see a bunch of money come here if they decide that, you know, this, the control of the Senate is going to hinge on what happens in Ohio. So even if the state might be a reach for Democrats, it might be their best shot, you know, the mechanics of trying to take the Senate. So that's something that, you know, isn't really top of mind for most people, but that's just sort of important to understand which races get prioritized.
You're listening to the All Sides Weekly Reporter Roundtable on 89.7 NPR News. Our guests today are Karen Kassler from the Ohio Public Radio Statehouse News Bureau, Andrew Tobias with Signal Ohio, and Laura Bischoff from the Columbus Dispatch. Transitioning to talking about child care federal funding a little bit, the Trump administration last week froze federal child care funding to all states, saying that it needs to investigate a series of fraud schemes at Minnesota daycare centers run by Somali residents. Governor DeWine issued a statement saying that Ohio has robust protections against fraud. There were nearly 5,200 state-funded child care facilities here in Ohio. So does anyone know what that means? What does Ohio do to, what's our robust protections against fraud?
I think one thing is that we pay on attendance, not enrollment. Fans of the electronic classroom of tomorrow remember that whole argument that, you know, are you as the state going to pay on the number of kids who are enrolled or the number of kids who actually show up? And the, DeWine said in that statement that the state is paying based on the number of kids who show up, not just the number of kids who are enrolled. He talked in that release as well about random inspections that can happen at any of these daycares, though. There's a real question about whether there are enough inspectors to have a lot of random inspections. I've heard Representative Josh Williams, who was the Republican who circulated a letter among his fellow Republican state lawmakers encouraging Auditor Keith Faber to do some more investigation. He's talked about potentially introducing legislation that would require a lot more inspections. Well, it takes people to do those inspections, so that's an important thing to think about. But also there's some payment related things that the state has cracked down on, dual providers or people who go to more than one daycare or whatever. So DeWine is, I think his statement was really to try to get it out there that Ohio is looking at this and that this is something that's already that the state is watching for, because some of those Somali-run daycares are getting threats. They're getting vandalized because of these unsubstantiated rumors that have been going around. I mean, the fraud in Minnesota is – the alleged fraud in Minnesota is alleged. Ohio, you know, there's been nothing that's been really written out. There's been, I think it's really very, very alleged. And
yeah. Is this like a manufactured problem, basically? Because Minnesota has the, it's of interest. Minnesota has the large Somali population. We have the second largest. So therefore, we get connected because these are Somali-run daycares.
Yes. That's exactly what's going on. And it's interesting because it's prompting like these citizen sleuths to go out and, you know, try and find out are these just boarded up buildings with, you know, where they're accepting state money, et cetera. And they're using, you know, these some of the things I've seen on Twitter, they're using like photos from Google Earth that are two or three years old. And then you go and you drive by the facility and there's cars out front and there's, you know, banners hanging, enrollment open, blah. It looks like an actual daycare. I think that these citizen sleuths are showing up at the door of these daycares and getting turned away. That's an appropriate response to a stranger showing up at a daycare center and saying, "Show me your children." You know, I guess as a parent, I would be like,
"No, thank you.
No, call the police and find out what's going on here."
Yeah. This issue, as you're saying, got more attention because a right-wing influencer posted a video claiming he found the fraud in Minneapolis. And so, and then we have the vice president, J.D. Vance, weighing in, and he applauded this video that had 100 million views. And he said, quote, "This dude has done more useful journalism than any of the winners of the 2024 Pulitzer Prize." So like, it seems like the vice president is taking this video as truth. I mean, what do we do with that?
Yeah, I don't report on Minnesota politics. There is a scandal there. There mm-hmm. are people who have been indicted. There are some people who have been convicted. They expanded child care availability in Minnesota. They adopted a Biden administration policy to pay based on attendance, not on enrollment. So that is a thing. But to say that because this is happening in one place, it must also be happening in another place, you know, I guess there could be things that we don't know about, but that's definitely a leap to assert that it's happening for sure.
When I talked to Auditor Keith Faber over the weekend, I asked him about, you know, fraud in publicly funded programs, and he said that he expects there probably is. I mean, that's the whole point of audits, and he audits agencies, not individual beneficiaries and programs that get that money that comes from the state. So he's set up a page on the web on his website to take in tips that he says can be acted upon. And that's one of the questions is, are they going to just get a whole bunch of tips that are just based on unsubstantiated rumors? But, you know, I think finding fraud in publicly funded programs has been something that we've heard a lot of talk about in general. But the real concern here is the focus on the Somali immigrants who are involved in these daycares. And I mean, you saw what happened in Springfield when there were all these rumors in 2024 about pets and they were unsubstantiated, but they really grew into these terrible rumors that had an effect, arguably, on the presidential campaign. So, you know, is this what's happening again? I think that's a question.
Well, and Laura, you know, you've written before about fraud, you know, pandemic era fraud. There's people who are in prison for it. So it's not that fraud doesn't exist. It's just maybe in this case we're looking in weird areas.
Yeah, I mean, fraud is it's sort of like a feature of these large government programs. And that's why you have to have officials who, you know, have safeguards and checkpoints and, you know, ways to monitor and go after it. But yeah, it does happen.
This is 89.7 NPR News and the Weekly Reporter Roundtable. Coming up, we are going to talk about the minimum wage increasing and the cold and flu season is intensifying. That is when the roundtable continues from all sides on 89.7 NPR News.
How does AI even work? Where does creativity come from? What's the secret to living longer? TED Radio Hour explores the biggest questions with some of the world's greatest thinkers. They will surprise, challenge, and even change you. Listen to NPR's TED Radio Hour wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to All Sides in the Weekly Reporter Roundtable. I'm your host, Amy Jurevich. With me in the studio, Laura Bischoff, politics and state government reporter for the Columbus Dispatch, Karen Kassler, bureau chief for the Ohio Public Radio Statehouse News Bureau, and Andrew Tobias, state government and politics reporter for Signal Ohio. In a bit of good news for minimum wage workers, the hourly rate went up on January 1st, and this is an increase that will impact about 150,000 workers. I have the numbers here. So, Karen, were you the one that wrote the story about minimum wage?
Actually, my colleague Joe Ingles did. Okay. But yeah, this is we all read each other's work. So,
yeah, there
in fact,
go.
All of us here read each other's work. Probably. yeah, I mean, you're talking about 150,000 of the 5.5 million Ohioans who are working will get that minimum wage increase. So $11 an hour. It's because there was an amendment that was passed in 2009 that requires that to keep going, that minimum wage to go up. The federal minimum wage does not go up. Wait, the federal minimum wage is not going up since 2009.
Right, and it was a ballot issue in 2006 unions put on the Ohio ballot. It got adopted, and basically it tied Ohio's minimum wage to the rate of inflation. And so that's why we get these little bumps each year. And so it's going up to 11. That's a 30-cent increase over last year.
And of course, there's been talk for years about raising it to 15. The group that was working on that failed to make the ballot the last time they did a real push toward it, and we haven't really heard a whole lot since then, I don't think.
Yeah, I think Secretary of State Frank LaRose, as that campaign was or was not going to turn in their signatures, called it a goat rodeo.
What does that mean? I don't even know what that means.
They were like, it was just super disorganized. And,
okay. They didn't have it together.
Yeah, I remember the deadline to turn in the signatures. It was Red, White, and Boom. So it's like, what streets are blocked for the giant U-Haul of paperwork they have to turn in.
Oh, they were trying to drive the papers in when during Red, White, and Boom.
Yeah, they just called it a day. They didn't do it. But yeah. It was a moment where we were wondering about that.
All right. So minimum wage went from $10.70 to $11 an hour. And that's for non-tipped workers. For tipped workers, it went from $5.35 to $5.50. Okay, and then the next topic I have is the cold and flu season. The Ohio Department of Health announced that the first child has died from influenza this flu season. The state said it was a teenager under 18 from Greene County, and the Ohio Newsroom reported that Dayton area hospitals and clinics reported an uptick in patients with the flu, with COVID-19, and with other seasonal viruses. So hospitals in Dayton are restricting visitors. Has anyone been following cold, flu, or RSV cases related to this uptick? No?
Not really. No.
Yeah, the Ohio Department of Health said that the hospitalizations in the last week of 2025 hit like 1,400, 1,500, mm-hmm. which is up almost double over the week before that. So, you know, the flu is pretty dangerous if you have compromised health conditions.
And it's not just Ohio. It's happening all across the country, which, you know, with people coming back from traveling, that could be a factor in seeing some of those numbers. But yeah, it's not just Ohio. It's happening. I think more than 30 states have seen significant rises in flu cases.
When announcing the death of the teenager, Ohio Health Director Bruce Vanderhoff said he told everyone that it's not too late to get a flu vaccine. Vaccines don't prevent the flu or COVID, but they can shorten the duration or lessen the symptoms. So he was still encouraging the flu vaccine in that press conference. You're listening to the All Sides Weekly Reporter Roundtable. We are talking with Andrew Tobias from Signal Ohio, Karen Kassler from the Ohio Public Radio Statehouse News Bureau, and Laura Bischoff from the Columbus Dispatch. I wanted to talk about a bill that Governor DeWine signed. He was under some pressure to veto it. It was an election-related bill that did away with the 4-day grace period for absentee ballots, meaning they could arrive within 4 days following the election. Now they have to be postmarked the day before the election. DeWine did say he was reluctant to sign it, but what did he say about why he signed it anyway?
Essentially, there's a pending U.S. Supreme Court case. It comes from a challenge the Republican National Committee made of a law in Mississippi that, like Ohio, allowed for absentee ballots that arrived after Election Day to still count as long as they had a pre-Election Day postmark. I don't remember what Mississippi's the number of days it could arrive late in Ohio was 4 until DeWine signed this bill. Mm-hmm. And he cited that case. The U.S. Supreme Court took up that case in Mississippi. I guess there's just a belief, because it's a conservative court, that they took up the case at all, that they're likely to strike the case down. I mean, I've definitely heard Ohio officials say they can't predict the future, so why would we act based on some unforeseen mm-hmm. future scenario? So I think that really says to me that DeWine was under pressure to sign this bill. I think it's something that Republicans want to do. I mean, it's something that the Trump administration has threatened to sue Ohio over. I mean, we have an election year next year. Do all these Republicans running really want to do so while they're being sued by, you know, the leader of the Republican Party, essentially? So that's what he said. But, you know, the governor did say several years ago when he signed another bill that created a new photo ID requirement for voting and some other restrictions, that he felt that the issue was settled, that he didn't want the legislature to send him any new voting restrictions. And, you know, they did it anyways, and he signed it anyways. That's mm-hmm. kind of what happened.
Yeah. Jen Miller with the League of Women Voters encouraged him not to sign it, but he did sign it. So basically now, if you want to do an absentee ballot, you have to make sure you get it to the post office at least the day before the election. That's the law.
That's been the law. And mm-hmm. it's just about how long do you think it will take for it to arrive at your local board of elections? Mm-hmm. So if the answer isn't 12 hours, then you shouldn't do it under this new law.
Yeah, it's how much faith do you have in the U.S. Postal Service to get it on time? I think this is a provision that's going to disenfranchise procrastinators. Mm. There were about 8,000 ballots received after Election Day in the November 2024 election, and the Secretary of State's office says that was like 0.012% of the total number of ballots cast. However, we're told all the time that every vote counts, mm-hmm. and so this is just another provision in which people are going to have to be a little more on top of things to make sure that their vote is counted.
And there is a new rule that the Postal Service is putting into place that really defines that whole idea of postmarking. But of course, this bill, the postmark is not as important as the bill being in-house. And so really...
So the ballot has to arrive.
Right.
The postmark doesn't necessarily matter.
Yeah, the ballot is supposed to be in-house on election night, which is interesting because if you vote provisionally, you still have 4 days to go back after the election to cure your ballot, to prove that you are who you say you are. And of course, military and overseas voters were carved out of this because of federal law that protects them. So this is... I think Secretary of State Frank LaRose even testified to what Laura just said about that there were ballots that would have potentially been thrown out under this new law that arrived in that 4-day window. And so I think people need to be aware that that 4-day grace period is no longer. And if you are voting by mail, you need to find a way to get that ballot back to the Board of Elections before Election Day.
Do Ohio lawmakers have something against procrastinators? Like, why even bother with this?
I mean, clearly not. If we just follow the legislature and how often they, have to wait until 3 a.m. the night before a deadline to pass bills and
stuff.
Okay,
so they're procrastinators too. Ha. all right. Well, he did sign it, so there we go. And then I wanted to catch up on one more piece of news that happened before the holidays. Governor DeWine is not happy with Ohio State University and other colleges and universities that are not teaching the science of reading, which became law in 2023. A state audit of Ohio State was one of 10 schools listed as, quote, not aligned. There were a few schools, Capital University and Ohio Wesleyan, who were partially aligned. And the governor got a little salty about it. Here is what he said.
For some universities, cultural, it's set in. They've used it, they've taught another way for a long, long period of time. And it's tough to change. Look, it's tough for professors that have been teaching one way to teach another way. But it's also tough for teachers who are out in the classroom who now have to switch over. And so, it's just a moral imperative that we get this right, and we get it right damn fast.
So we know DeWine is mad if you use the word damn. So, Karen, have universities offered an explanation why they're not aligned, why they're not teaching the science of reading?
Well, I think that's, it takes a while to move, I guess, and especially when you're talking about some of the biggest universities in the state. But the question is, how do you make that happen in the timeline that the state has given them? It was supposed to be by the 1st of January 2025. Now they're moving forward to push that a little bit further. But it shows that DeWine is really serious about the science of reading, which was put into the budget. He's gone around the state to different classrooms, observing the science of reading being taught. And we've heard a lot of different things about reading and different ways to teach reading. But this is the one that DeWine and most other states are saying produces the best results.
Andrew, what do you make of DeWine being so passionate about this particular topic? There's so many topics he could be passionate about.
DeWine cares about the kids. I mean, it's true. And he recently talked about this issue, and he talked about how in Mississippi they implemented the science of reading and went from the bottom of state, rankings when it comes to literacy to close to the top, although he said it took 10 years or so for that to actually kind of work its way through. And so he's nearing the end of his term. He's nearing the end of his time in elected office. So I just think he really wants this to happen, and I think he feels, kind of like urgency because of his waiting time to do anything about it.
I think even more fundamental than that is that, reading is the foundation for all learning. And, the longer you delay implementing, switching from a system that has not been working and getting over to one that will work for kids, the longer that delay happens, the more kids who are not served and who are kind of left behind.
Interestingly, the audio that just popped up was Jimmy Haslam talking about firing the coach of the Browns. So, I don't know if that has any connection to what Laura just said about changing course from what didn't work to what might work.
Is that what you want to end on, Karen? You want to talk about the Browns?
It's just once again, it's a change in leadership with the hope that something will turn out to be better. So I think that's That's a New Year's message that new year, new team. I don't know.
Well, with hope springs eternal, are the Browns going to get a new stadium? Where are we at?
Well, and that's something to look at, too, because mm-hmm. the transfer of unclaimed funds was supposed to start happening on January 1st, and then that was blocked. So that's still continuing because it was $600 million in unclaimed funds. It was supposed to be the state's portion of that domed stadium. But they're certainly planning on it, I think, in Cleveland and ready to go. So,
coach or no coach, they're ready to have a new stadium.
There's always how many coaches are we paying? Do we know, Andrew? We're paying a lot.
It's not possible to count that high.
Well, let's count the quarterbacks. No, that's fine. I digress. There is a hearing related to the stadium funding on Thursday, January 8th. So we will find out what that hearing says and talk about it again next week because it's our weekly Cleveland Browns segment on the Reporter Roundtable. I will end it there. This has been the Reporter Roundtable. Thank you to Andrew Tobias, state government and politics reporter for Signal Ohio. Thanks, Andrew.
Always happy to do it.
And politics and state government reporter for the Columbus Dispatch, Laura Bischoff. Thanks, Laura.
Thanks for having me.
And Karen Kassler, bureau chief for the Ohio Public Radio Statehouse News Bureau. Thanks, Karen.
Happy New Year.
Go Steelers. I'm Amy Jurevich on 89.7 NPR News.